From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Israeli Prime Minister calls the Iran nuclear framework a bad deal.
It leaves the preeminent terrorist state of our time with a vast nuclear infrastructure.
An Indonesian court rejects the challenge by two Australian drug convicts. Opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi talks about elections in her nation. And Muslims are chosen to build a special chair for the Pope. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. President Barack Obama says the framework nuclear agreement reached last week with Iran represents a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to bring some stability to the Middle East, stability that would be good for Israel as well as other nations. However, some members of the U.S. Congress remain unconvinced, and VOA's Victor Beatty reports a key U.S. lawmaker plans to go ahead with legislation requiring Mr. Obama to submit any final agreement to Congress for debate and a vote.
Speaking to the New York Times Sunday, Mr. Obama said he would consider it a fundamental failure of his presidency if, on his watch or as a consequence of work that he has done, Israel was rendered more vulnerable. He said that would not just be a strategic failure, but a moral failure. Asked what his message is to the Israeli people about the agreement, the president said while they have a right to be concerned about Iran, they should be equally concerned Iran is not able to acquire nuclear weapons. He said there is no better option to ensure that doesn't happen than the framework agreement reached in Switzerland. That framework is an outline to be used during subsequent negotiations on a final agreement by the end of June. Mr. Obama said Iran will not get a nuclear weapon on my watch, but he also expressed hope this diplomatic arrangement can, quote, usher in a new era in U.S.-Iranian relations and a new era in Tehran's relations with its neighbors. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on U.S. television Sunday called the framework agreement a bad deal that gives Iran a free path to the bomb.
It leaves the preeminent terrorist state of our time with a vast nuclear infrastructure. Remember, not one centrifuge is destroyed. Thousands of centrifuges will be left spinning uranium. Not a single facility, including underground facilities, nuclear facilities, is being shut down. This is a deal that leaves Iran with the capacity to produce the material for many, many nuclear bombs, and it does so by lifting the sanctions pretty much up front. So Iran will have billions of dollars flowing to its coffers, not for schools or hospitals or roads, but to pump up its worldwide terror machine and its military machine, which is busy conquering the Middle East as we speak.
Mr. Netanyahu says this is not a partisan issue or just an Israeli issue. It is a world issue because everyone will be threatened by a nuclear-armed Iran. U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, who took part in the negotiations, says the agreement will give the international community almost instantaneous recognition of any attempt by Iran to evade the deal. Moniz calls it a long-term arrangement.
There's no sunset. There will be a lot of phases, starting with extremely stringent restrictions on Iran's program. Hopefully, they will comply for a long time, build up confidence. But we have 10-year restrictions, 15-year restrictions, 25-year restrictions, and we have forever restrictions. So this is a long-term program, not something that will kind of go away in a few years.
Moniz says the agreement calls for unprecedented access to Iran's nuclear program, not just declared sites, but to any covert aspects of their infrastructure. The chairman of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Tennessee's Bob Corker, says many details of the agreement are not yet known, making it difficult to determine if it's a good or bad agreement. He says there appears to be discrepancies on how sanctions will be relieved. He also wants to know more about snap inspections, how they'll be conducted on covert aspects of Iran's nuclear program, as well as its military dimensions.
Again, I'm open. I know there are a lot of details that will be worked out over the next several months, and that's why, on behalf of the American people, Congress needs to be playing a role. What the American people may not know right now is there'll be all kinds of classified annexes that are very important. They lay out the details as to how much of this is going to take place. And that's why it's so important that Congress play its rightful role in approving this prior to the congressionally mandated sanctions that we put in place are alleviated.
Corker says his committee will go ahead with plans to vote April 14th on legislation requiring the president to submit a final agreement to Congress for a debate and a vote. It would prohibit Mr. Obama from suspending sanctions during a 60-day congressional review. However, he acknowledged he is uncertain if he has the required 67 votes in the 100-seat Senate chamber to override a presidential veto. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Victims of the devastating terrorist attack that left 148 people dead last week in Garissa, Kenya, are trying to pick up the pieces of their shattered lives. Gabe Joslow reports for VOA Television from northeastern Kenya.
The Kenyan military is keeping a tight grip on the town of Garissa after the April 2nd terror attack. Garissa County is under a nighttime curfew, along with three other counties frequently threatened by al-Shabaab. Garissa has seen sporadic bomb and grenade attacks in recent years, blamed on the Somali militants, but nothing of this magnitude. At Garissa Hospital, student survivors recount gruesome stories of a day of horror. One student, Quentin Anyango, says she was just getting up for an early study session when the attack began.
When I moved out, I saw other three strange people with a gun. I stood for a moment, then from there I decided not to go back to the hostel, but to look for somewhere where I can hide safely.
She hid the entire day, listening to the gunshots as her classmates were executed in a nearby lecture hall. She will go back to school someday, she says, just not here.
If it is Garissa, I don't see me coming back. Kamani, if it is anywhere apart from Garissa, I will continue with my education. Yeah.
Al-Shabaab said the attack was retaliation for Kenya's mistreatment of Muslims as well as its role in Somalia. But Muslim residents have been quick to condemn the terrorist group. Some local leaders have even called for Somali refugees living nearby to be sent back. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, in an address to the nation Saturday, said terrorists are plotting their attacks from within Kenya and promised a swift crackdown on those responsible.
We will not allow them to continue their lives as normal. The full force of the law will be brought to bear with even greater intensity than has been the case in previous years.
Meantime, victims of the attack are still looking for answers. At an accounting center in Garissa, workers keep track of which students out of more than 800 at Garissa University have been identified, dead or alive. David Muchiri, an instructor at a nearby college, has been poring through the lists and fielding calls from the worried parents of students still missing.
Well, it's traumatizing, I must say it is. It is really hitting us, even as people, as the neighbors of the university. We are really feeling touched because we don't know what could happen to us. Maybe we are next, we don't know.
The trauma of the attack will resonate in Garissa and towns across Kenya for some time, and any future retaliation by the government may only add to the tension. Communities here can only try their best to hold themselves together despite the forces trying to tear them apart. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Garissa, Kenya.
The Kenyan Interior Ministry Sunday said one of the al-Shabaab attackers responsible for killing nearly 150 people at Garissa University College Thursday was the son of a government official. The son, identified as Abdiram Abdullahi, was one of four masked gunmen who attacked the campus in the country's northeast, about 200 kilometers from the Somali border. Saturday, President Uhuru Kenyatta warned the planners and financiers of such attacks are deeply embedded in society and called on Muslims to do more to fight radicalization. Dania Bekele of Human Rights Watch told VOA's Victor Beatty the government's statement underscores the success groups like al-Shabaab are having in their recruitment efforts.
Al-Shabaab has been recruiting from Kenya not only ethnic Somalis, but also ethnic Somali Kenyans, as we have seen in some of al-Shabaab propaganda videos. I'm not sure whether or not recent news about one of the attackers being a son of a local government official is necessarily a sign how al-Shabaab is embedded in Kenyan government authorities, but it is certainly a sign how much al-Shabaab is recruiting from Kenya.
Is al-Shabaab now changing its tactics, similar to what Boko Haram is doing in Nigeria, attacking schools?
It has been doing this for a long time now, actually. So this is not the first time when al-Shabaab has attacked civilians or schools, students, hospitals, shopping malls, whether in Kenya or Somalia. You know, this is something they have repeatedly been doing, which is a terrible murderous attack against civilians, whether in Kenya or Somalia. It has been happening repeatedly. Perhaps the world media attention has come to know of the bigger attacks, But there have also been smaller attacks, particularly in northeastern Kenya and Somalia, targeting civilians, particularly students, including women and girls, which is a terrible, despicable attack.
President Obama plans to visit Nairobi in July in a phone call to his Kenyan counterpart, Uhuru Kenyatta. Mr. Obama last week late said that the two leaders will discuss how to strengthen counterterrorism cooperation and work together to build a safer, more prosperous future for Kenya and the broader region. Does Kenya need help given the criticism it's come under for the delay in response, security response to this attack?
Yeah, I believe Kenya needs all the help it can get in terms of strengthening its security responses. But I think Kenya equally needs strengthening its response in terms of compliance with rule of law and human rights. Some of the security responses that we have seen in the past were marred by serious human rights abuses, including extrajudicial execution, arbitrary detention, torture, and so on. You know, so I think this seems to, unfortunately, to fuel the crisis situation, as well as pushing some people into militancy, particularly from some of the disadvantaged population. So what is key in terms of the strengthening the response is respect for human rights and respect for rule of law.
The April 2nd attack was the worst to hit Kenya since the 1998 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, which killed 213 people. Washington says al-Shabaab poses a serious threat to Kenya and remains in touch with Kenyan authorities and is providing security assistance, including training and equipment. On Saturday, al-Shabaab issued a statement threatening what they called another bloodbath in Kenya. The group said last week's attack was revenge for Kenyan military action inside Somalia. Despite a decrease in deadly attacks, Cameroon says suspected Boko Haram fighters have been seizing food and livestock from farmers and cattle ranchers on its northern border with Nigeria for the past few weeks. As Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yuanda, most of the food producers are now relocating to safer areas away from the border.
The governor of Far North Cameroon, Midiyawa Bakari, says the armed insurgents carry out raids in groups of 5 to 10, seizing cattle, food and money from residents along Cameroon's border with Nigeria's Borno State. He says Cameroon's very long and porous border with Nigeria makes it possible for the insurgents to attack crop farmers, cattle ranchers and small businesses and quickly make a getaway. Sally Daru, a member of the National Assembly from Northern Cameroon, tells VOA some of the farmers who refuse to cooperate with the assailants have been killed. But the governor says the inability of Boko Haram to organize a major attack on Cameroon for more than 2 months now is an indication they are finding it very difficult to regroup themselves in Nigeria due to the offensives carried out by the new regional military force with troops from Cameroon, Chad, and Nigeria. He says he is very sure Boko Haram will be terminated soon and that today everyone can see that the end of the terrorist group is near. The last major attack by Boko Haram on Cameroonian territory was on January 10, 2015 at Fotokol, when about 300 assailants killed 500 people. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
An Indonesian court today rejected a last-ditch challenge by two Australian drug convicts facing execution by firing squad. But lawyers for the state and defense were divided over whether legal avenues remain for them to avoid the death penalty. Andrew Chan and Burana Sukumaran were convicted in 2006 as the ringleaders of a plot to smuggle heroin out of Indonesia. They had both challenged the Jakarta Administrative Court's decision not to hear an appeal against President Joko Widodo's refusal to grant them clemency. Plaintiff lawyer Leonard Apan Aritanga responding to the refusal for clemency.
Of course, I am not satisfied with the judgment today. But indeed, we will have to respect what the court has decided. But it's not stopping us to give our continuous effort. And therefore, we are about to file a constitutional review to Constitutional Court, asking the court to redefine, to emphasize what is the president's obligation in relation with the clemency.
The Australian pair are among 10 drug convicts due to be executed by firing squad. Others in the group include citizens of France, Brazil, the Philippines, Ghana, Nigeria, and Indonesia. Jakarta executed 6 drug convicts, including 5 foreigners, in January, brushing aside last-minute appeals from Brazil and the Netherlands. The next general election for Myanmar, also known as Burma, is set for late October or early November this year, with 63 political parties already registered to take part. Opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi sat down recently with Reuters to talk about the election. We get more on the story from VOA Steve Norman.
On the question of whether her political party, the National League for Democracy, or NLD, will boycott the vote, Aung San Suu Kyi said they might.
We don't think that boycotting the elections is the best choice, but we're not ruling it out altogether. We are leaving our options open.
She said the NLD is ready to govern, but if a military-drafted constitution that bars her from becoming president remains unchanged, and President Thein Sein remains insincere, as she puts it, then the election will not be properly carried out.
The playing field is not level, and the administration is engaging in acts which are discriminatory against the NLD. So we can't say that it's fair. So far, I don't think we can guarantee fair elections.
While upset about what she called the hardline regime, Aung San Suu Kyi emphasized the need to reconcile with the military, which detained her for 15 years until her release from house arrest in 2010. The NLD won Myanmar's last real election in 1990 by a landslide, but the military nullified the results. The party boycotted the 2010 poll, widely regarded as rigged, which installed Thein Sein, a former general and junta leader. I'm Steve Norman, VOA News.
The Catholic Church in Bosnia-Herzegovina has chosen a Muslim family of woodcarvers to build a chair that Pope Francis will use during a visit to the country in June. Traditionally, Bosnians make a new chair for every pope who comes to visit, but the honor has never been granted to Muslim craftsmen. We get the story from VOA's Latika Hoek.
The Hajdarovac family from the town of Zavidovici in northeastern Bosnia is famous in the region for carving wooden objects for everyday use as well as religious symbols for Muslims, Catholics, and Orthodox Christians. The family tradition started 50 years ago with Suleiman Hajdarovac, whose son Salim took over after his death and passed the skills on to his son Edin. When Salim learned in February that the Pope will visit Bosnia, he contacted the local Catholic Church and offered to build a chair for the pontiff. The proposal was forwarded to the church leaders in Sarajevo.
They invited us to talk and we reached an agreement. After the formal procedure was over, we started making this chair. I am extremely happy that we got the project because making a chair for such an important person is a huge deal.
The cost of the chair will be covered by private donations by members of the Zavidovici parish and the Hajdarovac family.
I had a discussion with my flock, and it was difficult at the beginning because people are struggling financially. But once they understood that it is about the Pope, the Catholic leader of the world, but who is coming here also as a political leader of the world, then people said, let's go. We will support this.
The family has agreed not to reveal the cost of making the chair.
It will be an honor for me and my family to build a chair for the Holy Father Francis.
What Edin Hajdarovac will say is that the chair is being made of walnut. Pope Francis will sit on it during a mass on June 6th in Bosnia's capital, Sarajevo. About 100,000 people are expected to attend. The parish priest, meanwhile, hopes the chair will make history.
With this, the Zavidovici parish will enter the history of Bosnia, and in a way, the history of the Catholic Church, and in the end, the history of the world.
The Hajdarovac family has put off all other orders to finish the chair by the end of May, when it has to be delivered to Sarajevo. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State in early March recognized 10 women from around the globe with the Secretary of State's International Women of Courage Award. They were honored for their outstanding contributions to peace, human rights, gender equality, and social progress. If we are to address and meet our most pressing global challenges, we must include women and girls, Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources Heather Higginbottom said during the ceremony. But too often, women have no voice in the political process or access to the halls of justice. Still, the voices of many are difficult to ignore. To amplify women's voices, three of the awardees formed advocacy groups. Maysaba Pugh is the director of the Gender Equality Network in Burma, a coalition of some 90 organizations collaborating to advocate for women's rights. She has been instrumental in developing Burma's inaugural National Strategic Plan for the Advancement of Women. After an outbreak of violence in Burma's Kachin State in 2011, Ms. May co-founded the Kachin Peace Network and the Kachin Women's Peace Network to raise awareness of internally displaced persons, of specific needs of displaced women, and to advocate for peace and reconciliation in Burma. Sayaka Osakabe sparked a nationwide conversation about discrimination against women in the Japanese workforce through an organization she founded, Matahara Net. One of the women she helped won a landmark Japan Supreme Court case in October 2014, ruling against pregnancy discrimination. Ms. Osakabe has advocated strongly, and the government of Japan has taken commendable policy steps to address the issue. Rosa Julieta Montaño Salvatierra of Bolivia has spent much of her life working towards protecting women's rights and to protect women from sexual exploitation and violence. 30 years ago, she founded the NGO Oficina Jurídica para la Mujer, or Legal Office for Women, which promotes gender equality through education and by influencing public policy. The organization has worked with the Bolivian legislature in drafting laws that help or protect women, such as stricter penalties for rape, greater protection for reproductive rights, and advanced gender equality laws. These honorees demonstrate to us what is possible when women stand up for their rights and freedoms, said Deputy Secretary Higginbottom. But they also demonstrate that we have a long road still to travel to achieve justice and equality for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.